And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. We're also on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm glad to be back, and my guest for the entire hour is fiction writer Jincy Willett. She's been on before, and I'm so happy to have her back again. She's the author of a number of novels and short stories and is here today to primarily talk about her latest novel, Amy Falls Down. It's a funny and poignant novel. Amy, the narrator and protagonist, is a writer who falls and hits her head on a birdbath, which sends her life in a new direction. She becomes famous, and so does her dog Ambrose, a basset hound. Amy's also dealing with the loss of her husband and trying to find her way back in since his death, though she would never admit it. Hi, Jincy.
Hi.
So what would you add to that?
I would add that the dog's name is actually Alphonse, but the problem with that is that I sometimes get too clever for my own good, and in the book, early on, when the reporter writes that fateful story about the odd interview, she misidentifies the dog as Ambrose, which has caused reviewers to think that was the dog's name, and I don't know why I expected that people would find that hilarious. It's not particularly.
And of course, I remember Ambrose throughout the whole thing, right?
Well, of course, and that's perfectly reasonable.
But now that you're mentioning it, it's like, of course, Alphonse, of course.
As in after you.
Aye.
So, yeah, I don't know if I would. The most fun that I had writing it, actually, I don't really have much fun writing, but the part that I actually got seriously engaged with from time to time was Amy's take on the whole publishing industry and the task of writing and the question of why we're all writing and so on. So I put in a lot of stuff about that.
Yeah, you did. I love that. Amy has quite a few opinions about agents, publishing, writers, and writing.
Yes.
And I mean, the murder of agents. I just thought that was just a funny way of putting it.
And I say that from a position of deep ignorance, because I have no personal reason to dislike. I mean, I don't have one, so I don't know any, and I'm sure they're just as nice as anybody else.
Right. You know, I wanted to talk to you about that, actually, because the other day, I think I was asking you something about agents, and you mm-hmm. said, I've never had an agent. And
yeah.
And yet your books continue to be published by major publishers. So mm-hmm. talk about that. How is it that you don't have an agent, and how is it that you continue to have big publishers publish your books?
I think because I got in on the very end of the slush pile era, which is, you know, the old way, to me, the established way of making your way as a writer, which is you just keep sending in stuff yourself, and mostly it gets rejected, and then every now and then it gets accepted, and then, you know, like a very, very, a snowball rolling down an extremely mild hill, mild slope, you know, you eventually rise. I mean, it was not necessary to have an agent when I was, and this wasn't that long ago, at least not in my mind. This would have been early 1980s, early to mid-1980s. The explosion of submissions of fiction happened probably right around that time, but it took the industry a while to realize that now they were, instead of getting, say, 100 unsolicited manuscripts a day, they would get 1,000 or something. And it changed everything.
Hmm.
I made up those numbers. I don't know what the numbers are, but I'm going by what Tom Dunn said in that Slate interview, and I'm sure he was right. It's just, that's the way it is now.
And then add to that the number of books that agents or publishers don't see. They're self-published. And there's
exactly.
So much material out there.
Yes. And while on the one hand, I think it's great that self-publication is a lot, you know, when I was young, it was vanity publication. And you'd pay money to these outfits for publishing and supposedly marketing your book. I think self-publication is now, it's doable, and once in a blue moon, you'll actually get self-publish a book and it'll be successful. And at least, I guess, you have some control over it.
Yeah.
But yeah. I don't know if these things ever get reviewed.
Yeah, and the marketing is a whole other thing.
Well, yes, and marketing is what really drives me crazy.
Yeah. Well, what about marketing? What about platform? Because Amy in the book has some funny things to say about platform. And, you know, as I was reading this, I started wondering if Amy was your alter ego or was another version of you, some version of you in an alternate universe or perhaps even this universe.
Yeah, she's definitely an alternate universe in which I'm a better writer than I am. I mean, she's supposed to be better than me, which is an interesting tightrope walk, you know, to write a story about a writer who's better than you means that you have to do a number of tricks. But, and the details of her personal life are not mine. But, yeah, sure, she's got my voice. She's just even more of a hermit than I am, and she's even more acerbic than I am. And that sort of was fun.
Hmm.
But all the stuff about being terrified of flying and not ever wanting to go anywhere, and that's all me.
Hmm.
And her ideas about whether they're well thought out or not about agents and platforms and so on are mine. And also, not just mine. I mean, they're shared by some writers that I know. We crab at each other about constantly. But we're all of a certain age. Yeah.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Tinsy Willett. The book we're talking about is Amy Falls Down. She has other books as well, Jenny and the Jaws of Life, winner of the National Book Award, the writing class, and her stories have been published in Cosmopolitan, McSweeney's, and more. And I should also say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California Regents.
Absolutely.
So another interesting thing I'll stop that, Amy, is that she doesn't much care for her growing popularity,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it always seems like right when you give up, that's when things start happening for you. And I don't know if that's what you were thinking or if it's just how you feel or talk about that aspect of Amy's personality.
Well, she's more popular. She becomes more popular than I will ever be. But I did. And I'm assuming this is true for writers in general. When you're young, you dream about being published. And you think it's going to be the most wonderful thing in the world. And it's lovely. It's absolutely wonderful. Getting published, especially the old way where somebody who doesn't know you says, hey, I want to put this in print, is wonderful. But, you know, put it in perspective, there are other things that are more important. And so I share with her a certain lack of, you know, tremendous excitement about the whole thing, the whole idea of recognition. I don't mind at all when people have no idea who I am. You know, if I introduce myself at a conference and they don't know who I am, that's fine with me. I don't have, and I'm always kind of pleased when someone does or someone's heard of me. When I get the occasional letter, email from a reader, that is very nice. I like, it's one of the things I like about the internet age is you can actually hear from readers now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful. That's probably what I enjoy more than anything, more than reviews and everything else.
Yes.
Because writing's an act of communication, ultimately, and that's all you're trying to do is take what's in your head and put it in the heads of people who read you, and then so if they check back with you and say, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, or I've had that experience, or that's great. That means I've accomplished something.
Early on, just a few minutes ago, you said you don't have fun writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you're pretty prolific, actually. I mean, you know, you're writing. So
yeah.
So what about that?
Well, according to my publisher, I'm not very prolific. I mean, they would like me to write more. I would like me to write more because, you know, you can make some money that way, and that would be nice. And also, having written something is nice. If I write something that I actually, looking back on it, think, hey, that's pretty good, that's great. I don't write unless I have something to say. So I mean, there's different ways to go about writing. I know writers that I tremendously respect have have certain rituals they go, or they'll make themselves write every day. I see them on Facebook saying, you know, I did, you know, 5 pages today, and they'll do that every day. And that, and I'm sure that's the way that I should be doing it. It's the way I worked when I wrote short stories way back in the beginning. I would get up and make myself sit there for an hour. You know, that's the extent of my self-discipline. But now I just write if the idea comes to me, and I really trust my subconscious to let me know if I have an idea worth sitting down and working on. And I think that's probably a little bit unusual. I think that most writers who are published writers and have written more than one book are probably much more disciplined and orderly than I am about that.
Well, one of Amy's opinions is that what separates the real writers from the wannabes is knowing what their story is.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe talk about that in relation to you and your work. I'm curious, you know, you were saying, you know, sitting down and writing and knowing what you're writing. How much of Amy Falls Down did you have before you started writing it?
When I write, I always have a general idea of where I'm going. I never do an outline because to me, writing it all down, even in outline form, would completely put the kibosh on any kind of desire to actually tell the story. You know, there's that, because once you tell the story in some form or other, whether you talk to somebody about, and then this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen, the impulse to tell the story disappears. So you don't actually say it out loud, you don't put it down in an outline, at least I don't. I know how the thing is going to begin. I knew it was going to begin with her falling and hitting her head in a birdbath. I knew it was going to be a novel about accidents, because accidents are interesting to me as a human being and also as a writer. And I knew that somehow or other, one little accident was going to slowly snowball into her being kind of blasted out of her cave, so that I knew that at the end she'd be in a different place as far as the rest of the world is concerned than she was in the beginning. But I didn't know what the specific steps would be. That's the exploration part of writing for me, and that's the, you know, you finish one chapter and you just wonder, okay, what's gonna happen now? And I really don't know until I write the next one.
Hmm.
And again, you know, some of us write that way, but many of us don't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would love to hear you read from Amy Falls Down. Would you do that?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I did that I thought was so incredibly clever, but nobody else has said that, so it probably wasn't, is because I had to write about a writer who was better than me, what I did was every now and then she'd sit down and write a story, and I would summarize the story. So I wouldn't have to actually write the story in Amy's voice, but I could summarize it. So this is the story that she wrote after she goes up to Radio KYJ in L.A. and has that ridiculous AM talk show thing.
Okay. Yep.
By now, Amy was used to her modestly active new writing life, one in which story ideas actually burgeoned more often than not into stories. True Caller was apparently going to be about a college dropout living in his parents' basement who spent his free hours calling radio talk shows. He made enough money at In-N-Out Burger to afford his own internet connection and some professional-grade voice-changing software. Amy had to do some online research to discover what technology was out there, which turned out to be alarmingly impressive. Voice changers were Google-flogged as though they were party accessories, like karaoke machine. Buyers were encouraged to have endless hours of fun with their friends. The non-fun-focused were assured that the software could be used for business purposes and for, quote, creating a stimulating conversational ambience, which Amy guessed was the closest the ads could legally come to the essence of a technology allowing phone stalkers to scare the hell out of women in the middle of the night. Her true caller, though, whose name eluded her, aspired to drive call-in DJs mad and ultimately to bring down the monstrous, rotting structure of radio talk show culture. By the way, this is not your radio talk show. He called them all, the right-wingers, conspiracy seers, preachers, celebrity mongers, advice gurus. He created distinct personalities, male and female, each with its own dialect, pitch, and backstory. Typically, he would agree with the host, opening with copious, breathless praise, proceeding to share an illustrative story, promising to support whatever point the host was making in that particular show. And at some point, the story would begin to veer off into the ether. At first, he just made stories nonsensical. One minute, he'd be talking about the damn wetbacks and how his Uncle Delbert couldn't get a job to save his life. And the next, he'd be yelling about tarantulas in his hat. Later, he's tended to stay focused, taking the host's message on race, Area 51, the Founding Fathers, or whatnot, and stretching it out to its darkest imaginable reach, forcing the host either to repudiate what he'd just been saying or to go on record as agreeing that we should repeal the 19th Amendment or perform live autopsies on environmentalists. The story bogged down as Amy wrestled with technicalities, mainly about how the caller always managed to dupe experienced screeners, and she wasn't sure it would ever amount to anything, but she enjoyed, actually enjoyed, creating all those personalities and took care to elevate each, however slightly, above its cartoonish beginnings. At the very least, True Caller was a great writing exercise.
Thank you. That was Jincy Willett reading from Amy Falls Down. There are so many laugh-out-loud moments in this book. Do you work these sections to get them as funny as possible, or does humor just sort of flow from your fingers effortlessly?
I think humor is... what I always say is I don't understand how you keep the funny out of things. So it's just I don't have to work at it in the sense of, you know, pumping it full of slapstick. I mean, I see the universe as just kind of slapsticky and not always in a hilarious way, but, I mean, sometimes it is. And the same goes for just everyday life. So, no, I don't work at it.
What a gift.
Well, it's a survival strategy. I mean, in terms of, you know, just seeing things through that lens in general, it can keep you sane, I think.
You know, I should say that the other aspect of this novel that I love is that there's this thread of sadness that weaves throughout because of the loss of Max, her husband.
Yeah. She's a very sad person.
She's a very sad person. So, you know, talk about layering it. If when that came into it, when you brought Max in, or if he was there from the start, and and just you know that layering effect that I think means so much. That makes humor work all that.
Well,
more.
It does. I mean, Max first came into it in the previous novel, The Writing Class, and. There, Max was just part of her biography, and in that particular novel, I was going for funny, scary, which I wasn't a very scary novel, but it had a couple of scary points in it. I think funny works best when it is combined with something else, just as in real life, so that funny, sad is just kind of natural. I mean, we've all had, I think, episodes and experiences in our lives that are both, you know, it's just natural. Again, it isn't anything you have to work at. Really, what you have to avoid is cliche. If you avoid cliche, if you don't let yourself slide as a writer into the rut of something that's been done a million times before, the layering will happen, naturally.
Can you say a little bit more about that? I think when writers think of cliche, they're thinking more of the cliched phrases or lines or metaphors or similes, and perhaps not, especially new writers, not going deeper to think of, you know, is my story cliched? Is this thread cliched?
The essence of cliche is the essence of sentimentality, which is falsehood. I mean, basically, if you slide into cliche, you're no longer telling the truth, which I realize is, you know, sounds like grasshopper, but it's the truth. So the Amy's truth, you try to make your character as truthful as possible, even though she's completely made up out of whole cloth or almost whole cloth. If I had had her, for instance, find true love at the end of the thing, you know, that would have been ridiculous. This particular woman is not looking for that. that would be a cliche. If she suddenly realized something, you know, at a convenient moment in the novel, that would be a cliche because that's not the way things happen. I wish I could think of a specific example, but
that makes sense.
Yeah.
What about Max? Where did he come from?
Max came from when I was creating Amy in the previous novel, I wanted her to be based on me, but I have this this ethical thing about not using the people in my life in fiction directly, not plundering. I mean, of course we plunder our lives, but not plundering other people's lives. I'm totally free to take myself and use myself any way I want to, but no, I'm not free to do that with my family or with people I care about.
Mm-hmm.
So that when, you know, I can't tell you, I mean, people will say, this character is based on me, and I just, you know, well, yeah, if you want to believe that, but honestly, God, it's not, because I wouldn't do that. I would never, ever do that. I think it's wrong. So anyway, I wanted her to be me sort of spiritually, her personality to be mine, and her general situation, being a widow, which I am, to be mine, and being a hermit and all that was me, but I absolutely wanted to avoid being any more particular about her marriage, because I did not want to use my husband and his death, and certainly not my own son and his life. I mean, that those are off limits to me. So basically, Max was a construct that allowed me to have a completely different biography as far as her marriage is concerned. And then he got interesting. I mean, so I made him gay. I made it a marriage of a Vietnam marriage, which he calls. But they still love each other. And he was just enormously important to her. So I could deal with her grief. I could deal with her life after his death. But at the same time, not flirt at all with the danger of using stuff that I didn't want to use.
Mm. Yeah, in a recent interview that I found with you, and I can't remember who, you were asked something similar. You were asked where the line is when you're writing about someone you know and or are close to, and you said if the character is recognizable, you know you've crossed the line.
Yeah. That's right. So Max is not recognizable. I mean, not only has he nothing to do with my life, my actual life, but I've never known of a situation just like that where you have a non-sexual, but, I mean, I know these things exist because I've read about them, but where you have a marriage that's actually successful, though somewhat hobbled by the fact that, you know, there's no sexual life between the people. The interesting thing to me about Max is if he had been born 20 or 30 years later, his life would have been very different, and he wouldn't have married her, and, you know. But these people came along at a certain time, and so that's what happened. And I like the character of Max.
Yeah, I do, too. I like him so much. So many of these characters are so interesting, and Carla, you know, toward the end of the book, she has changed her rainforest living room into cubicles, where writers come and pay to sit in a cubicle and write.
Don't you think that would work? That actually came to me at the last minute, but I thought, brilliant. Somebody should do, not me, but somebody should do this, because I think it would actually work.
Yeah, where you know, you have to come in, you clock in, you're at the job.
Yeah, and to me, and again, this is a matter of personality, that makes so much more sense than, I have friends, wonderful writer friends, who like go on retreats and so on. And that would drive me crazy. Maybe it's because my background is in white collar work originally, you know, secretarial work. But writing is work, and writing in a cubicle makes more sense to me than writing, you know, on an oaken table out in the woods. I mean, I'd be looking out the window at the birds, you know.
Oh, that's funny. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm with Jinsy Willett. We're going to take a real short break, and when we come back, we will talk some more. So don't go anywhere. Thank you. Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here with Jinsy Willett. Her newest novel is Amy Falls Down. Let's bring her back on. There you are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've been thinking about categories a lot lately. And so I looked on your copyright page, and Amy Falls Down is categorized as women's fiction.
Oh, is it really?
It is.
And oh, Lord, I didn't even know that. That's horrible.
Well, let me see what it says. It says women's authors fiction, life change events fiction.
And, oh, okay.
And so I am curious, you know, because to me, this is, I would say this is literary fiction. And I'm curious what you would say and how you feel about categories.
I hate them. I mean, so does Amy. I mean, it's not, yeah, she has a lot of fun with that. I just don't, it's a book, for heaven's sake. I mean, I categories are like fiction, nonfiction, somewhere in between. I mean, that's it. It's not, all right, I can understand categories for certain genres like mysteries, although not all mysteries. I mean, Kate Atkinson's, I think, if you have to say lit fic, she's a lit fic writer who can write mysteries or who does write them. Horror is a sci-fi, some sci-fi is genre, but it's just gotten completely out of hand. And I don't, again, that goes to marketing. To me, it's just obnoxious. What does that have to do with anything? If you start reading a novel, you know, back in the old days, you would just look at the spine of the novel on the new bookshelf of your library, and you could tell so much from the lettering.
Right.
And, you know, and then if you needed to, you could look at the cover. You'd know whether it was for you.
Yes.
Now, I suppose it was marketed as, you know, as romance or something or whatever. I don't know what marketing went into it, but the reader didn't have to worry about that. You could just, and then you'd open and you'd read the first couple of pages and think, this might be interesting. I don't know why we can't go back to that.
What do you think is the difference between literary fiction and women's fiction or commercial fiction?
Yeah, I don't understand what women's fiction is supposed to be. If I think about it too much, I'll explode. I don't get it. But
and there's a new category, book club fiction.
Yeah, right. What does that mean? What does that mean? I don't know. I mean, there's no reason why something can't be well written in the literary fiction sense and be a commercial hit.
Right.
I'm sure it happens once in a while. A lot of the times, the really big commercial hits are not particularly well written, but they plug into the zeitgeist. So, and good for them. You know, I wish them well. It's no skin off my nose, and I think that's great. But why we as writers should have to worry about, you know, what category? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose when you're querying an agent, they want you to say what category.
Yeah. What is your platform? Who do you write in the tradition of?
Right.
Which Amy says, I write in the tradition of me. I write in the if I were writing the tradition of somebody else, I wouldn't bother.
Right.
Now, as a matter of fact, you probably are writing in the tradition of somebody else because we're all building on one another, and
right.
we're all being influenced by one another. But to consciously write in the tradition of somebody is. It's insane. I just don't get it at all.
Yeah, it is insane. It's all quite interesting.
Well, and again, it may just have to do with the fact that there are so many people writing and so many people trying to get published that you just sort of naturally start coalescing into different categories. But I don't know. That part of it is unknown to me. I mean, until I talked to Tom about it in that Slate interview, I didn't realize how exponentially submission numbers have grown, and I didn't understand why agents were necessary. And now I understand that they are, because publishing houses can't handle by themselves the sheer volume of stuff that's being submitted.
Do you think any of that has to do with the proliferation of MFA programs?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, yeah. There's like hundreds upon hundreds where, you know, in the 70s, I think there were what, like 70, 50, 40, I don't
right.
know.
Right. And there of... again, what I've always said, I mean, I got my MA at Brown, and they don't give an MFA, but that's basically what it is in fiction. I did it because I was a faculty wife, and I you get certain perks as far as tuition is concerned, and I decided I didn't want to get an advanced degree in philosophy, so I went into this. And I had a lovely time, and I met some wonderful friends, but it really wasn't necessary. I mean, you get most, in my experience, you get most of the help you get from a well-run workshop. So I learned in a couple of workshops some basic stuff, just one or two principles, really, and then after that, I was on my own. So I think what people use these things for is networking, and I don't have a really high opinion of that either.
How so?
Well, again, what you write should stand or fall on its merits.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be a matter of who you know. It really shouldn't. Now, having said that, I have to admit that I know Tom Dunn, who's a senior editor at St. Martin's. But we were friends long before he ever got that job, and long, long, long before I ever even thought I was going to be a writer. I thought I was going to be a secretary. So, you know, that was an accident. Plus, I didn't, when I was sending out my short fiction, I sent it out to the slush pile.
Mm-hmm.
And I got published that way. So I don't feel as guilty as I might otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, don't you think, I mean, I just think that good work will eventually find a way, and it may take longer than you
right.
hope for, and it may drive
it
you
may
crazy.
It may be posthumous.
But somehow.
But here's the thing. Unless you just hit the jackpot, which you're almost never going to do, you're not going to make a living at it anyway. So what's the diff? I mean, you're going to have to get some kind of a job. And so even if you don't get published into your life is either over or almost over, that's okay in my view, because the essence, again, is communication.
Mm.
You're putting it there. I mean, to me, that's the thrilling. That's what really excited me when I realized the first book got published and read by almost no one was, oh, my God, I'm in the Library of Congress. I'm in libraries now. That means, you know, I can die now. I mean, I've done that. And maybe sometime somebody will read this, and maybe they'll think, hey, she's onto something there. I've had that thought,
mm-hmm.
and I'll communicate. I mean, that's, to me, the excitement of writing, of publication.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and everything else. There's so much out of your control when you're
right.
writing and trying to publish that if you can't enjoy some aspect of it, even through the misery of sitting there
right.
for so long, then really, what's the point?
Well, you're looking to perpetuate the same excitement that you had as a reader
mm-hmm.
when you were young, when you first discovered books, and later on when you just these eureka moments that happen when you read something and you really make that connection. That's why I love that speech that Hector makes in The History Boys when he talks about the author reaching out and taking your hand, even though the author is long dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's that's what it is. Writing is perfect for hermits, too, because you're not reaching out with your actual hand and touching them. You're operating at a deeper level.
Well, Amy also admonishes writers to grow a thick skin. She says that if you're getting rejection slips, that means you're sending stuff out there.
That's right. That's all it means. It doesn't mean anything more than that. I mean, I suppose if somebody kept getting the same, we're not taking this because it's, I don't know, it's contrived. I don't know, some base. And if everybody is giving you that feedback, then maybe it really is contrived and you should think about it. But that never happens, because usually if you're not published, they'll just make something up, and it'll be a different reason for each rejection.
Right.
And I don't blame them. I mean, they're not working for you. They're plowing through manuscript after manuscript.
It's kind of like critique groups, too, you know, where you could have everybody in the group having a different opinion about the same piece.
Mm-hmm.
And, it, you know, their opinions come from, you know, what you read,
right, and
the
their own personal
like.
Experiences and how they. But the nice thing to me about a workshop, which I still run once in a while, is that you can get a consensus if you actually listen to people talking about your stuff. Certain truths can emerge. Maybe they won't. Maybe everybody will just have some weird, different take on what you've written. But you can notice if a certain pattern emerges about your fiction. You can actually get helpful information that way,
mm-hmm.
much more so than you're going to get from the average rejection slip.
Yes, yes, agreed. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Jincy Willett. The book we're talking about is Amy Falls Down, and in a couple of weeks, on I think April 11th, Jincy will be on my panel at Literary Orange. So if you're in Orange County, come to Literary Orange. It will be tons of fun. I love going there every year. Lots of panels. Marie Stone, a co-host here at Writers on Writing, will be moderating a fiction panel as well. So it's going to be a fun day. You know, I wanted to ask you about your plot twists, because you have a bunch of mm-hmm. really crazy things that happen. And, you know, one is Amy meets Patrice on the plane. Another mm-hmm. is a train accident. Another is Alphonse becomes a hero.
Right.
And so I'm curious if those sorts of plot twists happen because you were sitting there going, what should happen next?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's make this happen. Or if somehow they worked into your storyline earlier where you knew at some point you had to bring this thing in.
No, all of those happened organically. They happened as I went along. And I think that's why, I mean, if you agree that they work, I think that's why they work, because
yeah,
they
I
were kind
they
of
work.
A big surprise to me. I did have in the back of my mind that there should be some sort of actual accident, but I didn't know what it was going to be until she went off on her jaunt on the train, and I thought, oh, that's what it'll be. And I spent like a couple of hours looking at Google Maps and trying to figure out, okay, where would be a good place for the kind of train accident I have in mind. I love the internet. It's just so good
yes.
that way.
Yes, yes.
and Alphonse himself has been a joy to work with. He just generates his own ideas. And so the idea of a service Basset I thought was hysterically fun. Anybody who ever owned a Basset would find that amusing. And of course, he would be a hero. He's actually been a hero. He's based on a real dog. I can use my real dog because that isn't unethical. My real Basset passed some time ago, but the Basset is wildly popular with people, and I actually had an interview on NPR with the dog lady because of the Basset.
Oh, really?
Which I thought was so funny. I mean, I said to her, you know, this is not a real dog.
So we yeah, what a great character he is.
He is. Well, Bassets are great.
Yeah, he's a great character, and then Amy's agent, Maxine, saying, you know, what if we give you this disorder, or maybe you could get this disorder
right.
so you could travel with your dog. You know, it's just a riot.
Yeah, well, but stuff. Anyway, what you were asking about, whether it sort of yeah. happens as you go along. Yeah, I needed Patrice on the plane. And that whole chapter was so difficult to write because I am so afraid to fly that I didn't even want to look at the... I didn't even want to look at YouTube videos of flights, but I had to in order to see what planes look like now. The last time I flew, it was on Eastern, so that was some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is so frightened and so messed up, and she's taking her Klonopin and stuff, that that Patrice just sort of, he was just naturally, I mean, when you're in a state like that, that's when you're apt to meet a Patrice. Who saves you, you
yeah.
know, with the story.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the accident. I mean, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, ooh, what if this happened? Well, that's basically what happens in real life. I mean, you're sitting there minding your own business and then there's an accident. So I think working that way is helpful.
Hmm.
It's you end up with not a contrivance is what I'm saying.
Right. Right. And it just seems that when something needs to happen in this book, something does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you're monitoring yourself in terms of your own interest level Do you find yourself becoming sort of like, oh, I don't know, I'm kind of getting bored, and now I have to entertain myself? Like, how do those things...
You mean
things,
when I'm writing?
Yeah, when these surprises, when these plot twists happen.
Well, I always have to be entertaining myself. If it's a slog, I'm just not going to write it. I don't have that much... So every chapter has to be entertaining to me on some level. It has to be interesting. Very often it'll just be, I'll set myself a little small puzzle that I have to work out, or, you know. But yeah, I think every chapter is an entertainment, not necessarily to the reader, but to me.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's quite entertaining. But I also really love the writing advice that's sprinkled throughout. I think it's great.
Well, I hope so.
I was curious if you hear early on in the, well, it's not early on, it's on page 161. Amy's talking about a couple of her friends and writing process and getting out the notebooks. And she says, one more thing, she said at last, reaching into her bag for notebook and pen. We're here to discuss writing, not publication. Do not ask me about agents. Are there any questions? And I was curious if that is something you maintain in your workshops, when you do workshops.
Like, yes, I do. I do. I mean, I will very briefly on the first day, you know, answer a question, but it'll be in the form of, honestly, I don't know anything about that, and you should go to somebody else if you want information about agents and publication. I, you know, tell them what I know. But usually when people come to those things, they know as much or more about the whole publishing situation nowadays than I do.
Hmm.
So, yeah, to me, publication is completely separate. It's not, you don't come to a workshop, you don't come to me to find out how to get published. I try to help people write as well as they can.
Yeah.
And then whatever happens next is, you know, up to the gods.
Right, right. What about, you know, we've touched on it, platform, a bit, but, you know, I see you on Facebook, and your posts are usually quite funny, and I'm curious what your relationship with social media and platform and all of that is. I mean, are you on there kind of because you feel you must be? Do you do what's fun for you and that's it?
It's strictly fun. I or somebody started an author page that I've been trying to get rid of, and I can't. It's just they won't let me get rid of it. Once in a while, like when I'm about to start a workshop, I'll put on something saying, if you're interested or you know anybody who is, we're starting at this time. And like, for instance, I shared the post that you did the other day about the radio show today.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, no, I don't like using it for that. I one of the reasons I use it is to see what my son is doing. My son's this wonderful musician. He has great musician friends, and I get to read their posts, and musicians are wonderful. So it's mostly musicians and writers that are posting.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find it fun. Probably too much fun. I probably am wasting whatever creative energies I have doing that rather than actually writing.
Well, before we go, I wanted to talk about another thing you do well, and you deal with time and time transitions in time really well. I think it's on around 287, toward the end of the book. You have Amy and Alphonse going to Union Station. And she is, you know, at one point she's going to the station, and then she's on the train.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't deal with, and then she checked her bags, and then you just go right into the time transition seamlessly.
Mm-hmm. That's what you have to do. I think all writers do that, don't they? I mean, what you have to figure out is, I mean, that's a great thing about writing. If nothing important happens between when they're standing on the platform and when they're in the compartment, then you can just go right there.
Yeah.
It's just sort of basic. And I'm glad that you think that it works well. Honestly, I don't think about it much.
Mm-hmm. So when you have your draft, is that when you revise, or are you revising as you go along?
I revise as I go along. I don't write all that fast, and I don't make huge revisions after I'm through. I mean, after I finish, I'm basically I end up with the semi-final draft is the first draft, if you know what I mean. Then I have to go back and look through it. But yeah, I'm not one of these people that writes a million drafts.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of the best writers do exactly that.
Hmm. Well, this book works pretty well, so.
Well, thank you. I hope my dog is not bugging you. Do you hear that barking?
I do.
I'm sorry.
I do. That's okay.
She's a puppy.
That's okay. Well, we have another minute or two left, and I wonder if there's any writing advice beyond what we've already talked about that you would want to pass on to our listeners.
Well, my basic writing advice is don't think about being a writer, just write. Being a writer is not all it's cracked up to be, but writing something that that's true, seeing with your own eyes, hearing with your own ears, and writing in your own voice, that's worth doing. So figure out what your story is and write it.
Yeah.
That's really blobby, but that's all I got for you.
Right. No, figuring out what your story is, that can be
uh-huh.
the hardest thing of all, it seems.
That is hard.
Anyway, I will see you in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Jincy Willett. Her novels, Amy Falls Down, and many others, short stories. She has a website, jincywillett.com. And as I said, she'll be at Literary Orange in a couple of weeks. They have a website. It's an event put on by Orange County, California Libraries to benefit the libraries. So if you can make it, that would be great. It would be great to see you there. And I think that's about it for today. If you want to get in touch, go to penonfire.com and shoot an email my way. And otherwise, we will be back here next week with another guest with more talk on writing. Thank you so much for being with us.